What's the difference between a person and a personal brand? What's the difference between self and self-presentation? Don't worry, that is not the setup to an absolutely terrible joke. Instead, they're questions I think quite a bit about. Human beings have always navigated the space between their inner worlds and social spaces, between who we are and who others recognize us to be. But the context and conditions for how we do so have changed dramatically over the last 30 years. In the digital era, our sense of security can hinge on the way we shape our image. I am endlessly fascinated by how this affects our lives, our relationships, and our work. And I am not alone. In her most recent book, Doppelganger, Naomi Klein writes, "Self-branding is yet another form of doubling, an internal sort of doppelganging." Now, Klein has been in an odd relationship with her own form of doppelganger for the last 20 plus years. Because Naomi Klein is often confused with another Naomi, Naomi Wolf. Now, while Klein is an anti-capitalist, social activist, and feminist, Wolf has become increasingly enmeshed in the world of conspiracy theories. She's lost her tether to her more mainstream white lady feminism, which made her an advisor to Al Gore's very mainstream presidential campaign. Wolf's wild claims and cozy relationship with Steve Bannon create a baffling backdrop for the frequent mix-ups with Klein. In Doppelganger, Klein offers some fascinating first-person analysis of the way we double ourselves online. She writes, quote, "Am I who I think I am? Or am I who others perceive me to be? And if enough others start seeing someone else as me, who am I then?" The doppelganger experience, as Klein tells it, is one in which reality becomes a sort of funhouse mirror. We've put ourselves out into the world as a collection of photos, videos, and words, maybe a website, a logo, and some brand colors. But no matter how hard we work at those things, our digital selves are not who we are, not really. Our digital selves are doubles, doppelgangers. And therefore, Klein says, it becomes harder for anyone to know what is real and what and who can be trusted. I'm Tara McMullen, and this is What Works, the show that rethinks work, business, and leadership for the 21st century economy. This is the fourth installment of my five-part series, Decoding Empathy. Today, I want to use this idea of doubling ourselves as we go about our self-presentation online and also offline to consider what we actually know about others. And to do that, we're going to dive deep into, wait for it, copywriting. I want to think about how our own experiences of being misunderstood or misrecognized by others can help us adopt a more critical and intentional analysis of how others present themselves. How can the lack of curiosity we've all been subject to at some point help us be more curious about others we encounter? Now, a good copywriter is someone who never lacks curiosity about others, their clients' clients, and anyone their clients might encounter out in the world. But before I introduce you to the very good and curious copywriter I interviewed for this episode, let's think a little bit more about our doppelgangers. They there is a profound tension between who we are and who we want to become. In the best case scenario, the tension is a creative one. We accept and love who we are while we tenderly cultivate our ever-changing selves. In the worst case scenario, we deny who we are and we mold the shape of who we want to become to resemble whoever economic institutions want us to be. We can see both scenarios, as well as all the gray areas in between, all over the internet. Naomi Klein observes that the social, economic, and environmental destabilization we all experience, quote, places demands on us to change, to reassess, to reimagine who we need to become. Now, if we direct those demands toward an image of self that we love and accept, asking who we need to become to meet this moment is a fruitful exercise. However, we're more likely to direct those demands to an external commodified image of self. Who do I need to become to get the job in this environment? Who do I need to become to weather this social storm? Who do I need to become to deal with this algorithm change? Who do I need to become to hold on to what's mine? We take our best guesses at the answers to those questions, and we create digital artifacts to share who we think we need to be with others. Those others can offer the approving likes or comments, or better, they can reach out and hire us. Our doppelgangers receive the validation, or lack thereof, that for a time can substitute for a more complete sense of self. But after investing so much time and energy into our digital doubles, it can become too much to bear. The work required to maintain the doppelganger can overwhelm us. It's not only maintaining the constellation of images, opinions, values, meanings, and ideas that form the doppelganger identity. It's also the weight of others' expectations. It's not only self-representation. It's also relational 4D chess. No matter how authentic we intend our doppelgangers to be, no matter how personal our personal brands, eventually we realize they can never be us. We are dynamic, contradictory, fluid, transient, quixotic things. Now, even when we discover this about ourselves, many of us fail to apply the discovery to others. We recognize that we are not who others perceive us to be, no matter how carefully we've sown those perceptions. But we forget that the same is true of everyone we meet. Our expectations can thwart empathy.
As a writer, I think it's fun. I think it's like characters, you know, characters in a story. And telling stories is the whole point of like what I do.
That's Samantha Pollack.
I am a positioning strategist and a copywriter. Essentially, I have a method for drilling down deep and finding out who my clients truly are, why they're doing the work that they're doing, and then who they work with, and translating their mission, drive, purpose, whatever, into language that their ideal customer will connect with.
In the first episode of this series, I mentioned that marketing and copywriting taught me cognitive empathy. I'd always been intellectually interested in how people think and why they believe the things they do, but copywriting gave me a practical toolkit for that curiosity. So I asked Samantha to share her process and offer a behind-the-scenes look at how empathy works in practice.
So when I first started being a copywriter, like professionally, it was around 2015, I had, you know, methods and templates and things that I had learned from mentors and training. Every copywriter has some sort of intake process, mm-hmm. but what I would find when I would approach a piece of writing is I would like go through sort of a standard boilerplate intake form, and then I would sit down to write and realize I have no idea what to say. I have no idea who this person is. I have no idea what they do. And it was so crazy because I'm like, I talked to this client. I felt like they were a good fit. I know I can write their copy. Now I'm sitting here staring at a blank page. I got nothing. And so I just started asking other questions. And it really just started from like, it's the kind of writer that I think I am, where I just need to know every single freaking thing down to the teeniest, tiniest detail. I need to know all of the things so then I can sift through all of them and decide which is the nugget and then where to sort of follow that trail. And so over the years, I've kind of developed my own process to get what I need. And it's a lot of it is to cut down on the time of intake of like, I don't like to give my clients too much homework. But the truth is, if you're going to work with a copywriter and you're not doing homework, then your copy is probably not going to turn out that great. I mean, I start with like basics, like, you know, what do you do? What are your service offerings? How you price them? Like, who are your people? You know, I ask like weird questions like, what kind of music do you like to listen to? Who's your style icon? What are you looking at online right now? And it's like not really related to their business. That part is like the personality bit.
The intake process for a copywriter like Samantha is like a really great first date. Sure, you got to talk about the basics. Where were you born? What do you do for a living? Do you have siblings? Yada, yada, yada. But quickly, you move on to more interesting stuff, the weird questions that tell you a hell of a lot more about the other person than what fits on a resume.
I make mood boards as part of my intake process, just because I think it's fun. But also, like, clients are usually really delighted by it, and they're almost always pretty surprised to see what my take is. And it's not like, oh, now give this to your designer because this is your color palette. Like, I'm not a designer.
Right.
I have come up with a lot of ridiculous color palettes doing my mood boards. but it's more for me to like have a visual inspiration. I'm a very visual, like arty farty person. So it helps for me. And I have like the whole section of that that's like just voice, vibe, and personality. So I'll do like brand words, like a lot of them. And like sort of attitude. I also do something called a word shit list, where we have like a list of terms and words that we're not going to use because they're a cliche or people just need to stop saying them.
Samantha's process doesn't stop at curiosity and empathy for her client. Her curiosity and empathy also extend to the client's potential clients or customers.
I will read every single thing about you online. It's a little stalkerish, but I get paid for it, so it's okay. I look at all your social, like whatever content exists that you've created, I will absorb, but I also will look at like who are the people that are commenting on your Instagram posts or like on your things. And then I'll like go down little rabbit holes and be like, what's this lady's deal? And part of that is that's kind of a gift because that's your clients or your people, your followers talking in their own words freely. And so to me, that's like a real gem. Although you have to sift through a lot of, I guess, sand to find that gem. But I mean, when I first started, I used to go on Amazon and like look up related books to like the topic of my client and then read book reviews because people who read books have a lot to say. Like a 3-star review is like where the money is. So basically, I'm looking deeply at the ideal customer and kind of like their psychology and their vibe and personality and not just like what problem do you solve and like the kind of boring, obvious copywriter stuff. Like, yes, that too. But I'm also just looking at like, why do they care?
Why do they care is a critical question for practicing empathy. We want others to be interested in us, in our ideas, in the stuff we find fascinating. But why would they care? That question isn't meant to suggest that what we care about isn't worth caring about. Not at all. Why do they care? Ask how our interests connect to the other person's interests. The question reminds us that who we are and what we care about is not who others are and what others care about. And maybe that sounds obvious, but given how much I've seen people struggle with this question, I really don't think it is.
I feel like if you actually did this in conversation, it would be like so douchey, but I always am asking, so what? Like, so what? So you help your clients like have a moment of self-care because of this nice candle that you made that has a playlist that comes with it. It's really cool, actually. So what? You know? And then you just like every time you ask that, you get like a layer deeper. And a lot of that stuff does not end up in the final copy. It's more just so that I can understand very deeply what it is that's actually happening. And then I feel like the copywriter skill comes through where I'm like, it's a sell them what they want, give them what they need kind of thing where I'm like, but they don't care. They're not like searching for a self-care moment. They're searching for a candle that smells good, you know?
Yeah.
So translating like when it needs to be that deep and when it doesn't need to be that deep. But I need to see like all of the deep stuff before I can kind of figure out how to like prioritize all of the stuff in messaging.
Essentially, Samantha needs to make an informed, best guess hypothesis about who her clients' people are and what they care about in order to strike the right tone. She has to extend her empathy and curiosity to her clients' prospective clients to tell them what they need to know to make a good decision about buying. Years ago, in my corner of the online business for ladies internet, it seemed like there were only two acceptable ways to speak online. Now, the dominant strain was based on a particular personal brand written by a particular copywriter. Words like juicy and burning and sacred seemed like magic. Now, obviously, plenty of folks still think those words sound like magic today. The slightly less dominant strain of copy was punctuated by completely unnecessary four-letter words. Actually, it wasn't punctuated by four-letter words. They were part of the substance being communicated. And that substance most often amounted to, "I'm not one of those juicy, burning, sacred ladies." Okay. That was about as harsh as you'll ever hear a critique from me that's not directed at borked systems of power and exploitation. There were and are incredibly brilliant women who used both the strains of copy. But it didn't take long before all of those ear-grabbing, potent-as-hell words became devoid of meaning and substance. Those strains of copy became doppelgangers of doppelgangers, derivatives of derivatives. Everyone sounded the same because no one sounded like themselves. So with all that in mind, I asked Samantha how she learns to write in someone else's voice.
I ask clients a lot for voice memos, or if I have a client who has a lot of video content, I get really excited. It's like I try to absorb the cadence of somebody's speech and hear it in my head before I put it on the page. So a good kind of example that I'm thinking of is like your use of slang. Everyone's relationship to language is a little bit different. And the way that you use language is a little bit different. I work with a lot of women of color. Mm-hmm. And so early in my career, I was like so paranoid, so white girl paranoid about like using AAVE in my copy, even though I'm speaking in someone else's voice. And like, obviously that's natural for them, but I like felt like such a poser and was going through my own white thing. And then there's also like a balance of how you would talk in person or on video on a webinar versus how you want to sound in your emails. It might be slightly different. Mm-hmm. So there's a little bit of back and forth that's like literally happening with the client on the surface. But a lot of times I will find that people who have really strong personalities are just afraid to like have that represented on the page. And I say the page, I mean the screen. They're afraid to have that represented in a written way for various reasons. And it takes practice, but I also, like, I have to be careful not to, like, create a caricature of a person, you know, but most of my clients are not like me in various ways. So, like I said, most of them are women of color. I have to avoid adopting the language of my clients because I know how to write in their voice. Just have to be mindful of remembering my own voice. So I will talk about a client that I worked with recently. She is, like, a like fiery Latina queen, and she's this badass like business person. She spent a ton of time in corporate. I do not know her life, and I was developing her brand personality, and I was like noticing that a lot of what I was saying would feel like, tell me about a cool Latina woman who has this business, and I would just make it up, you know? I was just aware of that. I mean, I wasn't wrong. I was basing my work on like what I was seeing on screen and what I was seeing in her reels and, you know, like the mood board that I put together. She was the only one who wasn't surprised. She was like, yep, that's me. So I think it's just a matter of empathy, I would say. Like, I'm really listening.
A caricature is a form of misrecognition, to use Charles Taylor's term. For Taylor, misrecognition is a sort of violence. If the way we are recognized by others forms a critical part of our identity, then when we are misrecognized, especially when that misrecognition is confining or demeaning or contemptible, our identity suffers harm. The result is that the misrecognized person can become imprisoned in a false, distorted, and reduced mode of being. Now, a copywriter could hold tremendous power in this framework. On one hand, they could easily misrecognize the client they're working for and unintentionally cause harm. On the other hand, they could also help provide the language and dialogue that Taylor argues is key to how we form our identities. Copywriters contribute to both the language and dialogue of their clients, but as we've already begun to see, they also contribute to the language and dialogue of the client's potential customers as well. Samantha has a few more empathic tricks up her sleeve when it comes to that part of the process.
I work for the client's customer more than I work for the client, if that makes sense. So I feel like my responsibility is to like make sure all those people that are on your email list are being really well taken care of. And that's what I'm thinking of first, because what you're really hiring me to do is take really good care of your audience so that they continue being your audience and, you know, reading your shit and giving you money and all the things. So for a customer profile, all of that, what have we already learned? I mean, I don't really mess with like demographic BS because who cares? Like, I don't care what kind of car you drive. I don't care what kind of magazines you read. None of that really tells me anything of value in terms of how to talk to them. I want to know, let's see, if you think of like a sales page and you think this is for you, if, like, I want to know what those bullet points are. And I think if for a sales page, it's like for a specific offer, but for like a customer profile, it's more like, I am for you if da 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 da. And, or you think of like your main offer that you sell, like. And so I think when people can think of their clients in more specific terms, instead of they're just like, oh, well, they're like really cool and, you know, they're like down to earth and they really care about their health. And they like, this is the kind of answers that you'll get if you just say like, who are your ideal customers? People tell you like pointless things. And it's not their fault. This is just not asking specific enough questions. But if you have them describe specific scenarios that they've helped people with, then that tells me a lot more, because then I could literally put that right onto a piece of copy and someone can read it and be like, oh, yes, that's me. I do like, you know, desires. Like, what do they want? What do they want in life? And what do they want out of their work with you? What are they frustrated about? What are their sort of, what's their day-to-day kind of like? Sometimes I do this before and after thing. It just depends on the client and the offer and the business model. But sometimes I do a before and after thing that I learned. So it's like, what do they have before they start working with you and after? And how do they feel before they start working with you and after? And the only time I do that is when I feel like a client is just really stuck with my intake questions and it gives them just like more of a structure to kind of think through the answers. So I have little things in my pocket. I don't use everything for everybody. I also do a chain of beliefs, which I learned from Andre Chaperon, which I think is really fun. You start by like, what is the belief that the person has like right as they click the button, right? Was there like, yes, it's happening. Like, what is the belief that they have? And then what's the belief they needed to have right before that? Okay, and then what's the one they needed to have right before that? And you like work all the way down until you get to like, what are their beliefs right now? Then you could flip it upside down and use all of that to create a structure for a sales page, which is like a nerdy fun writer thing. Or you could take each one of them and turn it into an email and then have an email series. People usually have testimonials and reviews, and sometimes I actually do client interviews. It just, again, it depends on the business model. Like if you have an e-commerce business, I'm not going to like call up your clients and ask them why they bought your product. E-com is like just a whole way easier situation than like personality brands. But yeah, if you're like a therapist, for example, probably not a therapist because that would not be HIPAA right. compliant, but somebody who is a service provider, if you have clients you do a service for, I would just talk to them. I had a Facebook ads manager that I worked with, and I talked to a couple of her clients, and I get more out of those conversations, honestly, than all of the rest of the stuff that I do, but it still all ends up in the same place. There's like a final deliverable that is like a customer profile. It's just a Google Doc. It's not fancy, but yeah, I like just ask them. I literally just ask them. So that's how I like get inside the heads of the people who are going to be reading the copy. And then, you know, there's an element of like just gambling to all of it. You never really, you could do your best to like prepare, but you never know. You might have done all the research and then something tanks and you just don't know why. Sometimes yeah. people surprise you.
Sometimes people surprise you. You can do all the research, harness all your empathy skills, utilize all the copywriting tools, and people will still surprise you. And if that doesn't happen every so often, well, you're not paying attention. It's time now to circle back to where we started. What's the difference between the person and the personal brand?
There are definitely times where I don't actually know the real person. I can tell when someone is showing me their personal brand and not their personal person. This has happened a lot. There's a client that I worked with for years, and I was very expert at writing in her voice to the point where you wouldn't know that she didn't write it. But I know that I never got to know the real her. I'm a very observant and perceptive person, so I think I know some things about her just from spending as much time with her as I did. Here's the thing. I am a person who is like very, very comfortable with vulnerability and realness. I am like aggressively comfortable with it. So like I will, and I think that's like a personality thing too, but like if I sense that I'm like making someone, especially if it's a man, uncomfortable with like just being real about something, I will just turn it up to 11. And there are other people who are really not that comfortable with the vulnerability, especially the higher profile you get, the larger your audience gets, the more you have sort of created this personal brand that becomes its own, like you created a monster and now it lives outside you and you like have lost control over the narrative. This is an area where I really feel like the internet and the existence of online businesses and personal brands and online marketing has created a whole mess of like philosophical issues for us to grapple with.
I know.
I'm in a bit of like a choose my battles mode, and I'm kind of like, I can speak to my own personal brand and my own like person. To me, I feel like the disconnect between one and the other is just like too stressful for me. Mm-hmm. So I'm just trying to like show up and do what I do. I realize that I have a brand. I have a very like strong visual brand and I really like it. And I have a pretty strong voice. I should speak more. I have a very strong voice. And I think if you hang out with me in person, that might seem like the person you were expecting to hang out with, or it might not. And I guess I'm just like, I don't care. You know, I mean, I think for my clients, and I think this like speaks to who likes to work with me and who doesn't, is like, I want them to be real. I want my clients to be their real selves. I want them to feel like they're represented in the way that they want to be represented in their marketing efforts. And I want it to feel as much like them as they want it to. And I think the other side of this, the like sort of less kind of cynical side of it, is like you get to play and like make up a persona. You know, it doesn't have to be fake. It's just like you can lean into a part of your personality that doesn't get to see the light of day a lot of times. And sometimes that can be like armor, like Beyonce's Sasha Fierce thing. And sometimes it can be just like a fun, you know, like I have like a Lindy West alter ego that I kind of tap into when I'm writing sometimes, because I feel like her style of like ranty essay is kind of like right in my sweet spot. And so if I'm writing something like that and it feels like it's getting way out of control, I will sort of channel, you know, my inner Lindy. And you can see it as the voice will start to change of the piece when I'm like thinking of a different personality. So as a writer, I think it's fun. I think it's like characters, you know, characters in a story. And telling stories is the whole point of like what I do. And I mean, I think I'm a real writer's writer at heart. So I just want to like write good stuff. And the fact that I found a way to get paid for it is just like a trick I'm pulling on the universe.
Playing a character, even being aware of our doppelganger selves, can help us express what we might not have been able to say before, as long as we remember that that's what we're doing, and that that's what others are doing too. Naomi Klein argues that the various ways we partition and construct our doppelgangers, including the personal brand and its contents, are all, quote, ways of not seeing ourselves clearly because we are so busy performing an idealized version of ourselves, not seeing one another clearly because we're so busy projecting what we cannot bear to see about ourselves onto others, and not seeing the world and the connections among us clearly because we have partitioned ourselves and blocked our vision. Seeing here is empathy. Seeing is curiosity. Seeing is recognition. I loved learning about Samantha's process because it was such a potent reminder of the way others are willing to see, to empathize, to be curious, to recognize. We're not all copywriters, thank God, but we can all learn a lesson from copywriting tools. We can learn that we might never know the whole person on the other end of the Zoom window, the chat box, or the cash register at the grocery store, but we can always learn more about them. Or, as Klein put it, doppelgangers, by messing with our heads and our illusions of sovereignty, can help teach us this lesson: that we are not as separate from one another as we might think. Huge thanks to Samantha Pollack for sharing her time, expertise, and experience with me. You can find out more about her and her copywriting services at cultofpersonality.co. That's cultofpersonality.co. My work on subjects like empathy, the self-help industry, and time is possible only because of listeners and readers who chip in as premium subscribers. If you enjoy what works and you want to see this kind of thinking continue, please consider upgrading if you have the means. For just $7 per month, you get access to my premium columns, live quarterly workshops, and discussion threads. Go to whatworks.fyi to upgrade. That's whatworks.fyi. What Works is a production of Yellow House Media, a podcast production agency for people changing the way we think about culture, creativity, leadership, and work. Our production coordinator is Lou Blazer. Our production assistant is Emily Kilduff. This episode was written and edited by me, Tara McMullen. Marty Seafelt is our audio engineer, and Sean McMullen is our fearless leader and executive producer. What Works is produced on stolen land. We're grateful to the Susquehannock and Conestoga peoples who stewarded this land for thousands of years before the arrival of white colonists. The Yellow House is on the unceded land of the Kutanaha Nation and the tribes of the Salish and Kalispell.